for our warm-up speaker, Tio.
Thank you.
Hi, everybody. My name is Tio. I'm an alcoholic. You know, my birthday card got signed last month, and everybody signed it wrong. They put T-I-O, and they put a period between the T and the O. It's just T-O. That's all they'd give me. When I was born, they said, you're not going to know a hell of a lot, so we're not going to give you a hell of a lot. You know, I don't know if you guys that moment of silence. I was hoping I didn't get up and step on my damn tongue. And I asked God to help me, and he laughed. So, but you know, we'll get down to business. I got here thanks to Judge Rose in 82. I didn't stay. I'd like to say I stayed, but I didn't. I went back out and did a little more research. And, you know, people thought that I was a doctor or something, a Chinese doctor, Tio, doing research. So, but, you know, he sent me to care school. And care school sent me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And, when I got to care school, this lady, she told me what all I had to do, and she said that, here, take this and have it signed 9 times. I didn't know where to, you know, I didn't have a teacher and I didn't know who in the hell to sign it. So I said, where do I take it? He said, to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous right here. I said, oh, I'm not an alcoholic. She said, yeah, I know. I said, this is only your 6th drunk driving. And I said, you can't be an alcoholic. So I got one after that. Anyway, you know, she gave it to me. 2 weeks later, she said, you come and see me every 2 weeks, and you go to class in there once a week. So the first 2 weeks came up. She said, where's your get well card? Well, she called it an AA card. And I said, it's out in the car. She said, go get it. So I went and got it. It looked just like this, nothing on it. And she said, well, you haven't been to a meeting yet, have you? I said, hell no, it's only been 2 weeks. She said, you can have that thing filled out in 2 weeks, completely front and back. And now I know I could, but then I didn't know. You know, I was trying to wiggle out of it. And she told me, said, you have to do 15 hours of community service work. I said, we're in the peak of season right now as a mechanic at Frozen Foods. I said, we're in the peak of season, and I don't have time to do that. She said, okay, go give 3 pints of blood, and said, we'll call that 15 hours. We'll call that your service work. So, you know, I wanted to give me something else for that card that she gave me. I said, how about this? Can you kind of lighten up on that? I haven't got time to do all this. She said, yeah, we can send you back on the Judge Road, and he can send you back out the road camp. And said, I said, oh, that's enough. I've done some time out there. And, you know, this guy he picked up his 10-year chip. He was my teacher, my instructor in there. And I asked him if I could go with him. He said, yeah, I insist. So that ship looked this big. It looked like a hubcap off a Pontiac. And he said, man, I'd like to have one of those. He said, you stay sober, you can have this one. I didn't stay sober. And I didn't get it. But, you know, there's a lot of us go out. I'm pretty sure that probably a third of the people in here, maybe half the people, have gone out before. But, you know, if you do, there's a trail right back, right through that door there, and right in here, you can come right back to another meeting. And I don't know if they're going to help you or not, but they damn sure helped me. You know, I've had some of the roughest years of my life since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've lived through them. If I'd been out there on the street trying to rummage through that sobriety, I'd have been a dead SOB a long time ago. But, you know, this will help you when nobody can. This will teach you how to talk to God. If you don't even know Him, I don't know God, but I asked Him for help. I asked Him for help before I got up here. And, you know, He's helped my jaws move. I don't know whether I'm saying the right thing or not, but He's helped me move. And Rick said I could only talk 10 minutes. And I said, "You mean that long?" He said, "Yeah, that ain't long." But, you know, you get me started and growed up, I go pretty good. And it doesn't last long. But, you know, these are some of my friends from where I came from down here. And I guess they love me well enough to come down 200 miles one way. And this was my wife's best friend. And he was my, well, he helped me through a lot of bad dreams and stuff and things that, that shouldn't happen to anybody. But, you know, I hope he's down here to help me now. We've often left him. We eat dinner. Thanks for the dinner. It was great. We eat dinner, and I thought, well, I finally see him come out of the building, and I was parked on the street. I think they were parked in the parking lot. Anyway, we made it. We made it on time. And he told me to watch my clock. Jesus Christ, I still got 5 minutes. How time drags when you're not having fun. But, you know, I couldn't have done this before I got here. I could not have got up in front of a bunch of people and talked. And it doesn't bother me now, because I know you guys are going to let me get in my car. If I get in my car, don't get in front of me. No, I love everybody here. And, you know, I hope they give me the same thing. I don't know. You know, we started a little meeting over in Lindsay. You guys are all welcome. I'd like to see this many people. It'll hold this many people. It's a church. And they said they used to have a lot of meetings there. I don't know why they ever quit. It's a beautiful place. And so you guys are all welcome there anytime. Whether you got a busted leg, or we'll help you in and out. I rode my bicycle up the other day. I got a three-wheel pedal bicycle. I went off the curb and went wrong, and I slung out in the middle of the street, hit on my rib, busted my rib, and a lady stopped there and blocked the traffic and said, "Are you hurt?" "I don't think so." I said, "Can I help you?" I said, "You know, I couldn't raise my bike up." I said, "Yeah, you can help me raise my bike up, back up on the wheel." And I got on there and got going, you know. And I don't know why I went up there. I just ride my bike almost every day and to get some of this off. And it's doing a pretty good job. I know that everybody here is not going to get a bike, but I stole this one, really. I paid $65 for it. It's over a $500 bicycle. And, you know, people, I think they're talking about me. You know, they said, "Well, that's a nice looking bike." Well, you know, if I get off of it, is it that nice? Sure it is. No. You know, I'm a comic by trade. That's why they named me Tio. 2-0, I think. But I won't be old till September the 11th. Next year I'll be 82 years old. And, you know, I know damn well I wouldn't live that long. I've been in, after I came back, I've been here 23 years. I tried to jack it up a little bit. It's 23 years. And I should have been here. You know, it'd take me, to get this far, it'd take me 33 years. You know, I didn't stay the first trip through. I had to go out and do a little more drinking and get one more drunk driving. And but you know, when I came back to that care school, those people were gone. and they had college graduates there that had never, ever been drunk in their life. They didn't know nothing about my disease. And, you know, I asked this lady, I said, have you ever shit in your pants? And she said, oh, my God, no. I said, well, I have. Not her, but I have. And, I asked her a few more questions. And they never did the things I did. And, you know, I'm not proud of what I did, but I damn sure wouldn't trade for what she had done. I'd like to have her education, but I'm glad I got mine through Alcoholics Anonymous. So, anyway, I'm going to hang it up. They're fixing to throw rocks at me anyway. Thank you, guys. Thank you.
Let's give our featured speaker a warm Tulare County welcome.
All right.
Thank you, Rick. I'm Bob, and I am an alcoholic. It's good to be back here. I was here a couple months back with Tio, and I really enjoyed the friendship and the people here and the program that I hear that people share here. I think Hawaii Bob was speaking the last time I was here, and there he is. Hi. But it's been a while. But I'm just real grateful to be here. You know, I can only share what my story's like for me, and I don't speak for Alcoholics Anonymous, although Alcoholics Anonymous has everything to do with me being here today. But it's my story, and I hope that there's something in there that you can relate to. And feel free after the meeting, if there's anything that you want to chat about, feel free to grab me. Do we have anybody in here new to sobriety? Okay, we're all sane and sober, huh? Or sober. Usually they start these meetings out with a joke, and since Tio didn't tell one, I'm going to go ahead and tell one. And I'll give you the PG-rated version instead of the R-rated version. But and it's actually a true story. Part of my early sobriety involved going to a lot of out-of-town meetings, because I was scared to death to not hang with people in AA, because I was really afraid I wasn't going to get this thing. And I'm not trying to make this sound easy, because it wasn't. But we would go to, every Tuesday we would go out of town. And my sponsor would go, his name's Roy, and he was with us the last time we were up here. Tio would go. There was this guy named Earl that would go. And we'd always go in Earl's car, because Earl smoked and knew we wouldn't let him smoke in our car. And his windows were nicotine stained. And he would cough so bad sometimes he'd drift out of his lane. But anyway, back to my joke, since Teal's back in the room. We would often go out of town, like far away, and find a new place. And the beauty of that was, and if you guys haven't done this, or gals, find a posse, people that you feel comfortable with. Catch a meeting somewhere else where you haven't gone, whether it's Lindsay or Knights Ferry or wherever. That's where I live, but you're always welcome there. And just go somewhere and get together with a group of guys that you feel comfortable with in AA, and you'll find that we are not a glum lot. You have fun, and you know this thing doesn't have to be, you know, sitting on the edge of your seat and oh my God, how am I going to make it through one more day? Those things really pass the time in your early sobriety. But what we would typically do is that we'd go to a meeting, and after the meeting, we would find a Baskin Robbins ice cream shop somewhere, and we'd get ice cream and have ice cream to eat on the way home. And we would usually bring a newcomer with us, and somebody that looked like they needed some company, and we get them laughing too. And with Tio in the car, you're gonna laugh; it's guaranteed. So we're going to this ice cream shop, and this newcomer is going towards the counter, and there's these two young gals there that were pretty attractive, and this newcomer is really trying to impress these gals, and I wanted to bust his bubble, and I go up beside him, and I said his name was Bill. And I said, Bill, it's okay. Just tell your dad you're gay. He'll understand. And just at that point, the two gals look up. And just like clockwork, Tio was so fast. He walks up and puts his hands on Bill's shoulder and says, it's okay, son. I already know. And uh, But you know, it's hard. I was telling Tommy before the meeting, you know, it's really hard when you get in that car. You might have had something happen in your day that was really painful and ugly, and you may not even feel like you can talk about it yet, but when you hang around with a posse of people in AA that, you know, that you can just be with, and maybe you don't feel you've got it together enough to even voice what's really bothering you, but you know something's tearing you up inside, and you don't want to drink, and you get in that car, before you know it, you're laughing until tears are coming out your eyes, and you may talk about it, you may not. But I know that by the time I got home that night, and it would usually be 10:30 by the time we get back, I forgot what I was worried about when I left, you know, and so many of those things have happened in my sobriety that, and those are blessings, you know, that is just purely a blessing, and we had a whole lot of fun doing it. When I can remember drinking when I was a kid, and I can remember loving that stuff from the first time I had it, and I know that's true for a lot of what I hear you guys share too. I can remember by the time I can remember in sixth grade, we had an underground fort in a field behind my parents' home, and we built an underground fort and put some subfloor on it for the roof, covered it with some soil so the farmer's tractor wouldn't find it and when he plowed, and we stocked that thing with beer. And we would go down to the bars a few blocks away, and we're these cute little sixth graders with these Modesto B newspaper bags, and we'd go in the back of these bars like the Glowworm and some of the other ones, and in the back, then they smoked, and it was so smoke-filled in there, the bartender couldn't see us coming in the back door, and we'd throw out a couple cases, put them in our bags, take off, go home and put them in our ground fort. And I can remember being so drunk at lunchtime. I come home for lunch and my mom thought I was eating the cafeteria and the school thought I was eating at home, and I'd be so drunk I couldn't make it back to school. Something seemed weird to me about halfway through my sixth grade year when I realized that even if my friends weren't going to go home for lunch, which meant get drunk at the underground fort, I would still go by myself. Even at sixth grade, I didn't have to have someone with me to love alcohol. I always loved how that made me feel. You know, I know some people said they threw up when they first had their drink. You know, unless it was, you know, cream de menthe or something syrupy like that. I absolutely loved bourbon. I loved booze. I loved everything about it. I loved how it made me feel. But I can remember by the time I was 15 or 16, I don't remember a day going by where I didn't drink. I never did. And my dad drank a lot, but if he knew what I was doing, he would have taken the belt to me, but I hid it most of the time. But I remember going through life like that, and I even got jobs where I could drink. I worked at a Mexican restaurant. When I cleaned up at night, they didn't care if I had a beer, except I'd fill a pitcher and drink out of that while I'm cleaning up, and everyone was gone. And next door, they had a liquor store, and when I got down there, they would pay me to watch the back doors and stock the refrigerator, and he didn't care if I had a beer every now and then, and of course, it was more like six. But I always made sure that stuff was in my life. And I remember going into the Air Force, and I thought, you know, that'll give me a chance to get away from my old friends. And one thing I could do is I could work. My friends didn't do that. They really got involved in more and more drinking, and they got involved in some drugs and stuff, and not that I was any better than them, but I knew I could go down that road too. And I thought, you know, I need to go in the military and get my ass together. And I went in the Air Force, and I found out they drank like I did. And if you did well at Commander's Call, they would put out a couple kegs of beer and outside the dorms, and everyone could have beer. And that went on for a while. And I remember I became a psychiatric technician. And at the end of our war, we were on the locked ward at Shepherd Regional Hospital in Wichita Falls, Texas. And anyway, I remember at the end of that ward, it was a locked door, and if we worked the night shift, we had to unlock the door and go in there and make sure all the people on the alcohol rehabilitation ward were in their bunks. And they had a buddy system. They had to do everything in twos. They went to the BX, they had to go as two. But I remember going in there to check on them, and they had this fake bar, and it was the SHIP, aversive therapy program at that time. And if I'm not saying whether it's good or bad, but they had this really cool looking bar in there, and everything else was dark, and I thought, wow, that's pretty cool. So I remember going in there, and I'm looking at that bar, and I'm thinking whether I should go back there and get some booze out of there, and I thought I probably shouldn't. And but I saw this picture on the wall, and it showed this guy holding his hand in his face like this, and he was sweating profusely and crying. And at the bottom of the caption, it said, "I can't drink. I can't drink." And boy, that just hit me in the stomach like a ton of bricks. You know, I knew that I had to drink. I knew at that young age I had to drink. I didn't see a problem with it because I could still go to work every day. I didn't beat my wife at the time, and Rhonda was already born, and you were born at Shepherd Air Force Base. My middle daughter, Bobby, is here tonight, and my son-in-law and my wife. I thought I'm not hurting anybody. I still bring home a paycheck. I still pay the bills, so what's the problem? And I went through life like this for a while, and I'm trying to get to this because I don't want to belabor you with all the details. But I do think it's important to share it because not everyone lost everything or got thrown in jail or whatever. That's just my story. It's not that I wouldn't have ended up there. I'm sure that I would have. I drove many times drunk and driving. I should have been arrested many times. Go drunk with my kids in the car, you know. But at the time, I didn't think that was a problem. You know, I'm sure I didn't think I was drunk. I'm sure I didn't think I was endangering their life, you know. And thank God nothing happened. But I went through, and I wasn't there as a father. I wasn't there as a husband. I was just existing. That's what my life was. I was just existing. And I really didn't know any different, so I didn't think that that was so bad. And don't you know, I still work anyway. And I remember going through life, and that marriage ended after a while when I got out of the Air Force, and I don't blame her. I certainly wasn't the husband I could have been. And I remember when I got out of the Air Force, I can remember I worked for schools. I did maintenance and stuff like that. And one of the things my dad blessed me with, I was talking to Sue on the way down here, is he worked his way up from a factory worker that got off the boat from Germany. He got off one day and went to work the next and worked there for like 52 years until he had to retire. And loved it and worked his way up to plant manager. But he could always work on things with his hands. And it may not be the prettiest job, but he could fix whatever he had to fix. And that's what made him a valuable factory worker and a plant manager and all that. But so I always took a pride in being able to figure things out and learn how to work on them. And I like to try to do it better than I saw him do because he had to do it on a limited budget. And I like to try to do a nice job. But anyway, I worked maintenance, and I remember painting a classroom one time and for the school district, and this teacher comes skipping in and says, "Oh, would you paint this room this color? And by the way, I'm off to Hawaii." And I thought, you know, that's the job I want to get, you know. I remember I had the GI Bill and I went to college and I got my teaching credential and I became a teacher. And I loved that. I absolutely fell in love with that. I worked with, I had a regular ed credential and special ed, but I love teaching special ed. I love working with kids that some were severely handicapped, some were autistic, some were emotionally disturbed. I didn't care. You know, I just never saw a kid that I couldn't work with. For behavior, I was always able to work with the behaviors. That never, and to this day, never bothered me because I think all of us at any given time can be in the same situation that someone could be with mental illness or with, you know, special needs. We're all dealt the deck of cards we have, and I think we're there to help people grow and be who they are and not judge them. And that's one thing I've always been blessed with. My family raised me that way. I did that and for a while. And I remember at that time I was on my second marriage, and I remember working and doing some concrete work for a neighbor. And me and this other neighbor, Randy, that lived next door when we lived in series. He drank like I did, and I really liked him. And this other guy was a teetotaler, and anyway, he wanted us to help him do concrete, and he bought some booze for us. And we finished the concrete work, and he washed out the trailer. He had a beer with us, and he left the rest of the case for me and Randy and thanked us, and we were perfectly happy with that. And he left, and Randy and I, of course, finished that case because that was our job. And Randy said, do you... And he really, something just hit him right in the between the eyes, and he said, Bob, do you think you're an alcoholic? And I remember looking at him, and I laughed my ass off, and I said, of course I am. What's the problem? And I'm not joking. I mean, some people would see that as, you know, you're laughing. That, I really didn't see a problem with that. I still worked. I didn't beat the kids. I didn't beat my second wife, and I still went to work, don't you know? And so I didn't see a problem with that. My dad worked every day. He would come home and drink, and he would be up early in the morning and get to work, and no matter what. I didn't see my dad drunk a lot. He just was always drinking, but I just think that was his nature. But for me, I drank to get drunk. I wanted that feeling. Anyway, I time went on and that marriage ended, and and you think a guy would be on a second marriage and realize, well, maybe there is a problem with you, Bob. Maybe you're saying that you're not hurting anybody. Maybe there's a problem you need to look at. You know, you certainly aren't the best husband you could be. You certainly weren't the best father you could be. Maybe you need to look at that. And I remember it was about 2 years after Randy had asked me that question that it just hit me between the eyes that, you know what, there is a problem. You know, there is a problem. And, you know, I remember breaking into tears. And you talk about that moment of awakening. I was... I remember breaking into tears, I was home alone, the girls were in school, I was taking some courses at the college and on the GI Bill, but I remember falling on my knees and this overwhelming feeling came across me that I hate my guts. And I don't mean, I don't want to use the F word, but that's what I said. I hate my effing guts, you know? And I did. I wasn't sugarcoating that. I really hated the guy that walked around on my skin. And it hit me right between the eyes that, you know, there's a whole lot of years I thought I was doing okay. There's a whole lot of years I thought I wasn't hurting anybody. And I hate the guy that walks around on my skin. And I didn't have the guts to blow my brains out, thank God. But I couldn't go on living the way I was living. And if you drank like I did and... you know, what brought you here, your moment of awakening, I hope you never forget that, because that's why I still keep coming back. I don't want that back, you know. I don't want that life back. But I knew I had to do something. I couldn't exist anymore. That was no longer an option. Get on with life or get out of life, but this is not cutting it, you know. This is not cutting it. And I remember it wasn't long after that my second marriage ended and... But anyway, I remember when I fell on my knees and I was in tears, and I was glad no one was home, and I remember saying, God help me, I can't do this anymore. I can't live like this anymore. And you know, the next thing I know, and I'm not a real big one on miracles and all that. There's a lot of people more spiritually sound than I am, but that's just my story. But the next thing I know, I was opening the phone book, and I'm looking in the phone book for Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I knew my papa, my mom's dad, was an alcoholic, and I knew that I drank like he did, and I also knew that I had the dark skin and features that he had, and he died of hemochromatosis and cirrhosis of the liver. And I probably, my family says I probably genetically am much more like him. And my mom did tell me about Alcoholics Anonymous. She said, if you ever find that your drinking is a problem, and she knew by then that I was an alcoholic, but she was the type that knew. If she told me, you're an alcoholic, the first thing I do is say, no, I'm not, you know. But she just put it to me that way. I think Papa was, and I wish she could have found that program. And if you ever think that's a problem, there's a program called Alcoholics Anonymous, and you might want to check into it. I don't know. Maybe it's not a problem. But I remember hearing that, and that seed was planted. So anyway, I remember getting that phone book and finding that AA hotline, and I called that number, and somebody on the other end of that phone answered, not only answered that phone, but they spent 2 hours on that phone with me, and they didn't know me from Adam, and I wasn't paying them a penny, you know, and this wasn't one of those treatment programs that I would listen to on the damn radio that would tell me that if I wanted to get help with my drinking, go to this program and they'll help you. I got tired of hearing those damn things because I didn't know what to do. But Alcoholics Anonymous answered that phone. And I'm not saying that treatment programs are bad. I think they're great. But I'm just saying for me that wasn't gonna be what's worked for me. And she spent 2 hours on that phone with me. She told me where a meeting was that night. And she talked about what happened with her husband and that he died in the streets from this disease and that she too was a recovering alcoholic. And I said, are you going to be at that meeting tonight? And she said, I don't know if I'm going to be able to make it or not. I'm on the hotline a lot and I work, but she said, I do hope you'll go and I hope you keep this number even if you don't go. And I went to that meeting that night and I didn't tell my family that I was going because I didn't think I would have the guts to make it back again. And so I went to a meeting and I'm sure that that second marriage hadn't ended yet, and I'm sure that she was just glad I was getting the hell out of the house. And anyway, I went to a meeting, and when I walked in that meeting, that's what I loved about First Street. Teal's been to First Street. It was an old meeting, and second oldest meeting in California, next to the Hole in the Wall group in Southern California. And it's closed now, but it's still called Modesto Fellowship, and it still finds a different church basement that will rent to them every now and then. Still in existence. But that place, the men's restroom smelled permanently of urine, and if you washed it with bleach, it still smelled that way. And they had these two coffee boilers that came off a Navy ship, and the coffee in that place wasn't the best. But I went in that place, and there was this, and that's what I needed. I needed a place like that, because I had this excuse. I hadn't lost everything, don't you know? And I walked in there, and I heard these people that used to live under bridges, some of them, and one guy was a businessman that talked about wanting to ram his car into a bridge abutment and not knowing, understanding why. But he was an alcoholic too. And, you know, I walked in there and you guys made me know that I belonged. You know, that I'm okay just the way I am. It doesn't matter if you make more than us or less than us. We're all just drunks here. That's all we are, trying to get well. You know, we're not bad people trying to get good. We're sick people trying to get well. And that's, you know, that's still where I'm at today. You know, I'm just an alcoholic, you know, working on sobriety one more day at a time. But there was this little wino in there named Fraley, and I used to drink with his nephew, and we drank a lot. And Tommy just died a couple of years ago, but he got involved in some other things pretty heavy, and he ended up getting cirrhosis of the liver and dying at about 56 years old. And I'm 58, so it's been a couple of years. But anyway, Fraley was a hobo. He walked away from his family in Oakdale and signed the house over to his wife and said, I don't want this anymore. I'm going to hop trains. And every time he'd make a few bucks, he would go to Tom's mom, give her the money, and she would get it to his ex-wife and the kids. But that's what Fraley did. And I'm walking in this meeting, and this son of a gun's in there, and he has like 5 or 6 years. And I'm thinking, holy shit, if you knew Fraley, he didn't do that. I never saw him sober a day in my life. He'd work enough picking cherries in Washington to get a lot of booze and stock up a little bit, get on a train and come back down here. But he never was not drunk. And this son of a gun was sober. You know, I thought, holy cow, if this guy can stay sober, there's hope for me. So that's what I mean. When you come in here, share your story. Somebody needs to hear that. Somebody needs to know where you came from, because that may be the only thing that saves a newcomer's ass. Because I came in there and my first thought was I probably ought to go back out because I hadn't hop trained yet. And then I hear this guy share, and he said, I couldn't understand why I had a perfectly good job as a salesman. I made good money. I had a company car, and I'm driving home from work, and I'm in a traffic jam, and I have this overwhelming compulsion to ram this car into a bridge abutment and kill myself. He said, now that's not normal thinking. When that got my attention. He didn't have to be Fraley Franks to tell me, but what I realized is that Fraley had the same disease I had, and that I was no better than Fraley. You know, when he talked about his pain and misery, that was the pain and misery I had too. And it doesn't matter what walk of life we come from. And that's what I love about this program, is we get away from that. You know, we're one alcoholic helping another. You know, whether we're man or woman, whether we're gay or straight, whether we're, you know, whatever race we are, it doesn't matter. We love you, and we'll love you until you help, you can love yourself. And that keeps me sober. You know, because my best thinking will tell me that it's all about me, and then I go back out there and I get caught up in me and Bob's will, and I get away from God's will, and pretty soon I'm wondering why this guy is all screwed up. So anyway, to make a long story short, those people made me feel very welcome, and when they called on me, it was almost when the meeting was over and I didn't know what to do, but I remember these words came out of my mouth that I had to say, and I said, "I'm Bob and I'm an alcoholic." And this weight came off my shoulders like nothing ever had. God, I can't express enough how beautiful that felt to be free of this, you know, of this tiger that was had me pinned in a cage. You know, there was some hope for the first time in my life. There was some hope from this damn disease. You know, and you guys shared that, and I had hoped that I might be able to get away from this, and I might be able to get a life. I also knew that somewhere deep inside me was the guy that I always wanted to get to know, and I just never got to know him. But I had that hope. And I really think that's what stopped me from wanting to put a bullet to my head. You know, I did have that little bit of hope, that glimpse of hope. And if that's all you have, hang on to that, because that'll take you far if you'll put your faith in a power greater than yourself. But I remember coming, and they told me, keep coming back. They said, if you don't ever understand everything about these steps, come back. Keep coming back. You know, you don't have to. And I didn't understand everything about these steps, but I came back the next night, and I wanted to. I couldn't wait until 8 o'clock came. And by the way, if you're new to this program and you're wondering how you're going to... If you're newer to this program, and I'm not saying this to brag, I'm saying this because I want you to know that this stuff works for you. You know, I came in 30 years ago. I have 28 years sobriety. Now, I'm not any better than any of you. Trust me. I'm just trying to stay sober today, too. But let me tell you this. If you're new to this program, you don't have to understand everything about these steps. You don't have to work them perfectly. But I got to tell you, if you are getting sober and you're not feeling like your life is getting better, it's because it's time to hunker down on the steps. You don't have to do them perfectly, and we're not going to cram them down your throat. It's not going to work anyway. We're as stubborn as you are. We know that, you know. But I got to tell you, there is a real freedom in this book, especially the first 164 pages, but this is what this book looks like open, you know. And if you open that book, you're going to find those first 164 pages talk about me, and they tell me what I need to do to get a program of sobriety. You know, it's real simple. It doesn't say, but Bob, you know, you're doing this over there, you got this job over here, it doesn't say that. It says you're a drunk, and this is how we think. We need to have a psychic change. And when the big book talks about that, all that means is we need to change the way we think. Our best thinking God is here, and if that worked, we would still be out there. Let's get real honest about that. And that's what I come here to learn on a daily basis. You know, all the college in the world didn't help me get away from this guy. You know, I still have to deal with Bob one day at a time. And I have to deal with how I think, and I have to realize that, you know, I don't always think normally. The most simple situation I can get the wrong conclusion out of when it comes to dealing with people and things like that. You know, and if you're like me as an alcoholic, we learn to sweep that under the rug so you don't notice that we're real insecure about that, but we are. And so we come here and we learn how to change the way that we think. And I'm not going to go into all of that, but I would like to touch on some of the key things. Because I don't want to see someone come in here and get sober and think, okay, I'm sober and that's all I need to do. If that's all you want to do, then that's all you have to do. We will not make you do anything you don't want to do. You're not going to do it anyway. You're a damn alcoholic and you're stubborn. We get that. But I hope that you'll come in here and realize there's a better way of life, and that these steps, the reason we really lean on these isn't because we're Gestapo agents that want to make you be uncomfortable. That's where the freedom of this program comes from. You know, when I came in here and I started working these steps, something happened for me that hadn't happened in years and years, maybe since I was a little boy, is I started liking the guy that walked around on my skin. What a miracle. You know, I thought it was just, and I was so used to life being just okay, just existing. I was so used to that, I thought that was normal. Well, the new normal is that you start liking the guy that, or the gal that walks around in your skin. And you learn that by working this program in your life. That's what they're taking us through. You know, this, the big book says in here that really the ultimate purpose of the big book is to take you to find a power greater than yourself. Again, our best thinking got us here. We need to do that. I've also got to tell you, I sponsor one gentleman that's agnostic, and he's got 27 years sobriety, and for him, and he's agnostic, and I'm not going to change that. And the chapter to the agnostic in here, I think it covers some information really well. But if you're agnostic, I want you to know that your sobriety is just as important and just as relevant for you when you share as mine is. And don't feel that if you're agnostic that you need to go out that door because I don't have the same power Bob A. does, you know. I hope you find your own inner strength, and I hope you find your own spirituality. Ray talks about, the guy that I sponsor in Sonora, he talks about Bill struggled with that himself in sobriety, and what he found and what through Bill's writings is that the spiritual part of this program, if you don't believe in a God, it's still the spiritual part of this program, if you'll think about it, is how we interact and with other people. It's that connection that we make, you know. And if you don't think that works, try holding the door open for someone and tell me why you feel better after you do it, you know. There's a spiritual connection there. Helping somebody that needs your help. Sitting with a newcomer for an hour or two because you don't want to see them suffer alone. Tell me you don't feel better after that happens. So, you know, if you don't have a higher power, don't feel like you don't belong here. You do. You've earned your seat as much as any of us. And I hope that, you always remember that. Sometimes I think we harp so much on our own program, we forget that, you know, it's a program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we're all, you know, some people may not have the same belief I do. But anyway, one thing that that I found when I came in here that was really important for me was that this guy sitting, I would hide behind this post-it at First Street because I didn't want people to call on me, but I didn't want to miss a word you shared. And this guy named Roy was sitting there, and I said, will you be my sponsor? And he said, I've only got 30 more days than you do. I can't be your sponsor. I said, I don't think you understand. It took all the guts I had to ask you, and I'm not going to ask anybody else. And he said, well, let me ask my sponsor. So he did, and his sponsor said, yeah, you can sponsor him. He's been my sponsor for 30 years. I still like what he has. I love that guy. He would go down to the fellowship on Saturdays if they had a work day. He'd call me up and say, hey, there's a work day. You want to go down and work and clean up the fellowship? I said, sure. He did it, so I did it. He went to a lot of meetings. He did it, so I did it. I had his phone number, you know. I called him. And thank God he wasn't a real pounded down your throat type. But he led by example, you know. But I know that I hung with the winners, and I know that I had that sponsor, and I can remember, and I'm not recommending this for anyone, but I was coming up on 2 years, and I came up on a year. I made it to a year, and I got to tell you, there was a pink cloud. You know, God really carried me that first year. And I didn't realize that, but I remember going up to get my first year medallion, and I remember just shaking in my boots, and I couldn't understand why. And it wasn't that I was nervous in front of people, you know. I liked the thrill of getting that 1 year medallion. And after the meeting, there was this older black gentleman named Lewis, and he was about 6'3", and he talked like he had cotton in his mouth, but he was the sweetest man you would ever meet. And he lived a pretty checkered past, but he became an alcohol counselor in his older age. And he would come up to me, and if he was sharing at a meeting or anywhere, I don't care what he shared, it was always exactly what was struggling in here. He always had a way of touching me with that. And he came up to me, and he put his hand on my shoulder, and he looked me in the eye, and he said, Bob, we're given the first year, but by the grace of God, and after that, we have to work for it. And that's what my fear was, is I hadn't got into these steps. He knew. And, I love the people in these rooms, you know. You guys have people like that in this room just like I did there. You know, that's what I love about AA. You know, I come in here and I meet people that I can identify with, you know. But anyway, I realized I hadn't worked a four-step. And I remember thinking, that a lot of things were coming up from my past that I needed to get down on paper because they were starting to really, really tear me up. And I remember telling Roy, you know, Roy, I need to meet with you in 2 weeks on a Saturday because if I don't get this fourth step done, I don't think I ever will. And if I don't set this deadline, I'm afraid I won't get it started. And he said, okay, 12 o'clock, 2 weeks from Saturday, I'll be there. And I hunkered down. And I can remember, if you haven't done a fourth step yet, I've got to tell you this. Number one, do yourself a favor and do it. Please, it's for you. It's really not because we tell you to do it. It really will help your sobriety. That's why we tell you to do it. Now, when you're doing your fourth step, if you haven't done one yet, don't be thinking about the fifth step. Don't be holding back because you're thinking, I don't want people to know what I did 2 years ago or whatever. I don't want anyone knowing about that. Have a separate piece of paper for that stuff. You know, that's okay. You're not doing the fifth step. Now you're just doing the fourth step. And don't be thinking about making your amends later on. You're not doing that yet. You're just doing the fourth step. We have to keep it simple. You know, once you do that fourth step, trust me, your sobriety, the rest just gets, it really does get easier after that. And the fourth step doesn't have to be so doggone hard if you just do it. There's a couple things that we need to know, or I did anyway, is I was told you may not do a perfect fourth step. Nobody does. You can always go back later on, deal with things in the tenth step, or you can do another fourth step. But don't feel like you can't finish it unless you've got every little nook and cranny. It ain't going to happen that way. We still have cobwebs up here at that point. So, you know, I did the very best one I could do, and I took God into those writings. I would pray to God, help me be objective, help me look at my side of the street. I need to get this stuff down. And if you're not sure about what to get down, it's those things that you think of when you've got everything to be grateful for in your sobriety, and that whenever you think of them, they give you that knot in the gut, like, oh shoot, why did I do that 2 years ago, or why did I do that, you know, 5 years ago or 20 years ago. Get those things down, because you don't want them to keep giving you knots in the stomach. We didn't get sober to be miserable. That's what it's for, is to give. That's how we deal with those, you know. The big book talks about you doing an inventory of your business. You go through and you look at the things that are still good, and we have some good character traits, trust me, we're not all bad. And then we have some things that really have caused us a lot of pain in our life, and those are the things we want to get down. Just like, you know, a wholesaler has things, if he doesn't get off the shelf, they're tying up his money, and he could use that money to buy products that are moving off the shelves. It's that simple. Get rid of the crap and get some good stuff in there. And then you're not going to get the good stuff in there, you're not going to fill that hole in your gut if you don't get that bad stuff out of there. That's all we're doing it for. We're not doing it to make you perfect saints. Don't go to the police department and turn yourself in. Just do your fourth step. It really is not a bad deal. And after I did that, I did the fifth step with Roy. And when I did the fifth step with Roy, he didn't judge me. He didn't comment on everything. He just said, are you done? And I said, yes. He said, okay. He said, that was good. That was great. And it was that simple. He didn't sit there and edit everything I did or none of that. He told me a few things that he struggled with that I thought, wow, I didn't think he did that. But, you know, it's neat to be able to get that down. He said, you can burn it or you can keep it. It's up to you. But you're done with your fourth and your fifth step. So, I went from there. And when you do amends, you know, first you ask God, ask God to take away these defects of character. And that's the best you can do right then. And that's great. You know, take God into that with you. When you get around to your amends, you know, if you're like me, I read that and I said, well, except when to do so would injure them or us, so be it. There's about half of them I just don't have to do. I don't want to hurt anyone's feelings. It doesn't say that. It doesn't say that, you know. What I found was there were things, though, that were... you know, my ex-wife, for example, for me to get into detail about what a jerk I was, you know, would have brought them hurt also. And I didn't need to do that. They suffered enough being married to me. And when I was at the peak of my drinking. And so what I said is, you know, I wasn't the best husband, and I really need to apologize for any hard feelings between us. That right there, if you think about it, if there's those ones you don't want to make, don't get into detail. That's not going to help them, and it's not going to help you either. Just say, you know, I'm genuinely sorry for any hard feelings between us. They know what it's about, or if they don't and they ask you, then tell them. But if not, you know, for me, that really worked well. And it gave them their dignity, and it let me do my amends. So try that. I think you'll find it goes a little bit easier. And there may be some you can't make right now. And don't stop on your steps because of that. You really really need to push past that. Some of them, the people have died, you may have to go to their grave site and say a prayer and make your amends to them there, you know. But don't let that stop you. If there's a few you can't do, we don't have to do this perfectly, we just need to do it. So go ahead and do it and move on to your next step, you know. Do it to the best of your ability. Sometimes we see people 2 years down the road, and what I find is my instinct now is to get up to them, shake their hand, and say, it's really good to see you, and I'm really sorry for any hard feelings that have come between us, you know, for my part in that. You'd be amazed at how many times people can't remember it, or they'll say, you know, I was kind of a jerk too, or whatever. That's, you know, and I just let them off the hook. I said, you know, don't worry about it. I just needed to apologize, you know. But they always accept it. Well, I've made more friends that way, I think. People I thought were my enemies became friends after that. So please just do them and keep that momentum going, you know. Man, I know that for me, when I came in here, I didn't know what the heck meditation was. So when you jump ahead to the 11th step, when you get to prayer and meditation, a lot of us know how to pray, but we don't know what meditation is. If you don't let that hang you up. Focus on your prayer. But if you get the chance to go to a meditation meeting, they're really worth their weight in gold because you'll learn how to. And I didn't know until I did. They have one up in Sonora. It's called the Meditation Group. But anyway, they take the first 15 minutes of the meeting. They open it up, take 15 minutes. They dim the lights, they do candlelight usually for it, and it's just for meditation. And you can sit there and think about whatever you want, you can pray, you can do whatever you want to. And you think, man, 15 minutes is a long time, I can't just sit for 15 minutes. You know, we don't sit still very well. And anyway, I tried that, and I got to tell you, 15 minutes went like that, and I was into some pretty neat thought. You know, and what it became for me was, you know, I'd pray and ask God for guidance, but it also was, it became mostly me reflecting on my day, what went well, and what I could have done differently, you know, the next time. And that's what I try to look at. You know, I try to find a time to reflect on my day. And sometimes I can do it when I'm working on a project or whatever, but those are the things I need to do, because, you know, if not, then I'm carrying a bunch of junk into my next day. But you know, that really helped me a lot. But if you don't get that, move on to the next one. You know, focus on your prayer and move on. When it gets to the 12th step, I hear a lot of people newer to the program saying, you know, that I can't do a 12th step. I don't have that much time, you know. And I tell them, you know what, somebody made coffee tonight. Somebody brought cookies tonight. Somebody turned the lights on. Somebody put chairs out. Somebody unlocked the doors. Somebody pays the bills at this fellowship. Somebody bought the coffee. There are jobs that somebody chairs the meeting. There are jobs in AA. There's a hotline that people answer even during the nighttime. At 2 in the morning, they'll answer the phone and be there for you. There's a lot of jobs in AA that you can help with. And if you don't have enough time, don't let that stop you. Get involved in service, because that's the only way, number one, that we can give back what was so freely given. This program doesn't cost you a penny. It was so freely given to us. And if you don't give that back, it really is going to affect you later on. The only way that I can get out of myself is when I work with somebody else. And that's what, you know, 12-step work really does for me. I don't bat an eye if somebody says, hey, can you come and speak at our meeting? You know, if you're thinking 2.5 hours is a long time, it's not. You know, I had a beautiful conversation with my wife, who, by the way, has been married for 20 years. I haven't screwed this one up yet. And I'm very grateful for that, because I love her dearly. But I have a nice time to share with my wife. I get to see my daughter and son-in-law and my grandkids, and I get to give back what was so freely given to me. You know, you guys were there for me. Somebody was sharing, you know, at the meetings and stuff that saved me. You know, it really did. I didn't know what to do. And somebody would share their story, and I've even heard people say it, and I hope you don't ever go through this, and say, well, I probably shouldn't share. It doesn't make a lot of sense. It makes perfect sense. You know, you're going to share something that's going to save somebody's ass, and please share it. You know, if nothing else, if you feel better doing it, get it out there. You know, we're here to help each other. But 12-step work is so important. It's a spiritual part of this program. It gets us out of ourselves. It tells us not to let our egos get too big, and it allows us to give back what's so freely given. And if you stop the cycle at that point, a lot of times you'll be sober, but you start getting miserable. You got to keep that cycle going. You know, if it's all take, you're eventually going to say, you know, what good is all this? Well, if you don't get that good feeling of reaching out to somebody or helping somebody or taking a phone call from somebody or taking someone to a meeting. Earl used to take people to meetings, and I don't care if they were homeless, I don't care where they live, I don't care if they stunk or not, Earl would go pick them up and take them to a meeting if they wanted to ride to a meeting. And if they didn't have a ride to get home, Earl got them home. You know, Fraley, that wino that used to hop trains, I didn't have the guts to go down the 4th Street Park in Modesto. People get murdered there. I didn't have the guts to go into the 7th Street Bridge. People get murdered there. Fraley would go down to those places, and if there was a drunk going through DTs, he would get him. He would pick him up and take him to his one-bedroom shack. It was a little tiny apartment and had a little bathroom in it and a kitchen sink, and that was about it. And he would take him, and he would let him stay there until they got, and he would pick up a jug of wine for him because that's the only way you're going to get them through DTs without medication. And he would get them sober. And then once he did, he would take them to meetings. And he would tell them, if you want to stay here, you can stay here. But if you drink, you're out of here. You know? Now, he had the guts to do that. I didn't have the guts to do that. So don't tell me that his 12-step work wasn't every bit as important or more important than mine was. It was. You know, there were people that Tio and I got to know that were products of Fraley grabbing them up and saying, if you want help, I'm here to help you. But I'm not going to put up with your junk. You know, he wasn't sweet about it, but he was loving about it. You know, 12-step work like that, I mean, it just, you know, when we reach out and help somebody and we see him get sober, trust me, that's what lights up our life. And that's why I think we're all here. And I can't say enough for that. The other thing that I would like to say is that, you know, as you get some time in and you feel better because you're not drinking and you don't learn how to live with life on life's terms, pretty soon we start getting miserable, you know, and that's one of the reasons I still go to meetings. I still go to a lot of meetings, and I know that doesn't work for everyone, but I still do. I try to go to a minimum of 2 a week. Sometimes I go to 3 a week. When I was early on in sobriety, I think I probably went to 6 or 7 a week. I went to a lot. I was afraid not to. Now, that's just my story. I'm not trying to make anyone feel guilty if they don't. But Tio and I have always gone to a lot of meetings. We make our connections there and our friendships there. And 95% of my friends in the world sit around these tables, you know. You guys are beautiful people, and I enjoy what you share because you share from the heart. But I go to a lot of meetings because I don't know. You know, I'll go to a meeting and I'll think, I don't really want to go to a meeting. So I'll go to a meeting, or I'm going to a meeting, I'm feeling like, you know, is this all there is to sobriety? You know, all I do is go to meetings and all this junk. You go to meetings for a while, and I show up at a meeting, and this guy shows up I've never seen before, and I've never seen him since. And he said, I have to be at this meeting. He said, I just got a call about 2 hours ago from the Reno Police Department, and they called me to ask if my daughter was Sally Jones or whatever, and I said yes, and she said she just blew her brains out in her apartment. And he goes, I have to be here. I don't have any choice. I don't know what else to do. I don't know where else to go. I have to be here. Now, when I'm walking in that meeting, I'm thinking, I don't know that I need to go to all these meetings. When I walked out of that meeting, I knew exactly why I needed to be at that meeting. I needed to hear that. You know, I thought my problems were so big. You know, he had the guts to get to a meeting after that happened. I know people in this program, and I don't want to tell their story, but that I love dearly, that have lost, you know, children from going back out in this disease, you know. And yet they still show up to the meeting sober. They didn't get drunk over it. How do you do that? You know, we learn how to live on life's terms, and the way we do it is through this program. And that's why we emphasize this. It's really not because we want to sell big books. I think we sell them at cost anyway, so it doesn't. But we really do. The longer that I am sober, here's the beauty of it. You know, people say time's not everything. It's not. If you have a lot of time and you're miserable, trust me, that's not a good place to be. But time is important, and it doesn't mean you have to have a lot of time. But I got to tell you, as you get more time, You learn how to deal with things that used to baffle you. And that's where the beauty starts coming in. I didn't come in here just to get sober. If that's all that I ever got, I think I would have left here a whole long time ago. I started liking the guy that walked around on my skin. And how did I do that? I came in, I listened to you guys. How did you get through something like that man that went through his daughter killing herself? And he showed up at a meeting. I needed to hear that. That told me that no matter how bad things get, my instinct needs to be to reach out to AA. Call somebody. I was coming up on 3 years sobriety, and the reason I have 28 years and not 30, Roy has 30, I have 28, is because I was coming up on 3 years sobriety, and my second wife told me that she wanted a divorce, and I found out some things that had happened that I couldn't deal with. My problem, not hers. And anyway, I chose to drink over that. Nobody made me drink. I chose to drink over that. I remember that the third day after I picked up the bottle again, I was drinking the same amount that I had picked up almost 3 years before, that I put down 3 years before. That's how much I was drinking again. That quickly, I went right back to needing that much again. Another thing happened that really scared me that didn't happen the first time around, because they say that our disease is patient, it waits for us. I can remember coming up on 3 weeks, and I can remember just being scared to death that I was not going to be able to put it down this time. It wasn't because I was afraid that if I came in this program that Rick or Tio or somebody was going to say, "We told you so. You guys don't do that," and I love that. I love you for that. It wasn't that at all. It was that I really couldn't put that bottle down. That stuff had me like it didn't have me the first time. This disease is cunning, baffling, powerful, and it will kill you. It really will kill you. I can name some people. In the last year alone in Oakdale, we've had 3 people die. Three of them blew their brains out. One of them had cancer and went back to drinking and was really suffering in a lot of pain for the cancer. And I'm not trying to judge him for that, but he also committed suicide. A couple years before that, I had sponsored a guy for a year, and he stayed sober, very successful guy, had a really nice job, and he had mentioned one time in passing, my doctor told me if I didn't stop this, it was going to kill me, and I wish you could meet this guy, really self-made man, and really great at his trade. He was the only construction superintendent for the Stockton Ports Arena and some of those venues, and only one of 3 inspectors in the state that could do the range of inspections he could do. And I had to call his boss once a week and say that he's still going to meetings, he's still sober. I've never done that before, but that was the only way he could go back to work, and he did. And after about a year, I felt like I was chasing him. And I won't chase you in AA. If I see that you're not wanting it, I'm not going to go sit on your doorstep waiting for you to come and answer your door. And I went to his house a few times, knocked on his door. I hear his dogs barking, and he wouldn't answer, and yet his truck was there. And he called me about a year after that. So he got a year in, and he said, "I need you to come over. I'm in the hospital. I need you to come over." And I said, "Okay, I'll be there." And I got down there, and I walked in the room, and he was as yellow as mustard. I'd never seen a human being that yellow. And he said, "I have cirrhosis of the liver, and they said that I don't have very long to live." And man, that just floored me. And he said, "I want you to know that you were a really good sponsor, and this isn't your fault." And so anyway, I sat with him, and then he was nodding off, and they had to come in and flush him out because his kidney couldn't work anymore. And a couple days after that, maybe 2, I was mowing the lawn at the house. He lived in Knights Ferry, not far from us. And he called, and he said, "Bob, can you come over?" And I said, "Yeah, could I come over? Would you mind if I come over tomorrow?" It was about 8 o'clock, and I wanted to get that finished, but I wasn't thinking. I just wasn't thinking. And he said, "No, I don't think I'll be here tomorrow." I said, "I'll be right there." And Sue and I went over. His wife had gone to Al-Anon, and that's an important part of my program too. I need to say that. That really is an important part of my life also. But anyway, we got over there, and I went in and I sat with him, and I said, "Mike, do you have a strong sense of where you're going when you die?" And he said, "I know where I'm going when I die." He said, "I have no doubt in my belief in God, my faith." And I said, I feel good about that. And he said, in my nightstand over there, there's two medallions. One's a 1 year, one's a 2 year. He says, just leave a 2 year there. I didn't earn that. I wasn't honest. He said, that first year, though, I earned that medallion. He said, I was sober every day of that, and you were a really good sponsor, and I want you to know that. And he said, you're one of only two friends that I have, and I wanted you to let you know that I don't want you to feel bad about this. And he said, and there's something else I want you to do. He said, I want you to take that medallion, and I want you to find somebody that's getting some sobriety, and I want you to give it to a newcomer that's working a good program, and I want you to tell them what happened to me. And I got to tell you, there was a guy in Oakdale, George. I sponsor Paul. Paul sponsors George. And I was able to give that to him a couple years ago and share his story. We don't have to go that way. I mean, these steps really are a better way of life. What I was going to say, though, in closing, is that we get more sobriety and we learn how to handle life on life's terms. And before you know it, you start having more good days than bad days. And before you know it, you learn how to handle situations which used to baffle us. And sometimes stuff will kick you in the rear end, but at least you know where to go to your toolbox to get those tools to make it through another day. And as you get more good days than those bad days, you start realizing that it's worth putting a little bit of effort into this program in order to keep those days like that and not let this guy, you know, which is out to get us, mess up my days. Anyway, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Rick, thank you again for dinner.